श्रीला गुरुदेव की जय, श्रीमन महाप्रभु की जय, श्री हरिनाम संकीर्तन की जय, श्री श्री गौराध माधव की जय, ग्रंथराज श्रीमद भागवतम की जय, श्री श्री ब्रह्म स्तुति की जय, गौर भक्त वृंद की जय, गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। सो good afternoon to all of you. Welcome. Thank you for gracing us with your presence today. And we are continuing with our series of lectures on Sri Brahma Stuti, or the prayers of Sri Brahmaji, which appear as they appear in 14th chapter of the 10th volume or canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, after the Brahma Vimohan Lila, where Krishna exhibits an unparalleled display of majesty in Vrindavan, the less expected place to find majesty, but the place where majesty exists in the most comprehensive way, although buried under layers and layers of intimacy. So Brahma is the one who witnessed this majesty and totally moved in his devotion. He's praying to Krishna after that, after realizing who Krishna is. According to our school of thought, we say Krishna is tu Bhagavan Swayam. Krishna is basically this fountainhead of all faces of the Absolute. Of course, when we speak about the Absolute, we will speak in terms of non-dualism, in one sense. Advaigyan Tattva, the Bhagavatam is saying the Absolute is non-dual consciousness. But at the same time, there is some qualification in the Absolute, or some degrees in which the Absolute can be approached and therefore perceived. Brahmeti paramatmeti Bhagavan iti shabdyate. So the Bhagavatam especially, and this Brahma Stuti in particular, will try to make a case for the ultimacy, at least on objective terms, of Bhagavan, or the personal form of the Absolute in connection to, and not only Bhagavan, but Krishna's too Bhagavan. So yeah, that particular face that we see in every single picture in this house, in every single altar, which is Krishna in Vrindavan, not even Vishnu, Narayan, or Krishna somewhere else, because you can find so many Krishnas. But as we spoke the other day, when someone asked our Param Gurudev, Srila Bhakti Rakakshya Dev Goswami, a typical question, he was asked, have you seen Krishna? And he replied, well, the Krishna that I want to see is not that easy to see. Or in other words, the Krishna I want, actually I don't want to see Krishna. I want to love Krishna, whether I see him or not. So that's even more difficult. I don't want just to make Krishna an object of my sight. So many people saw Krishna. Duryodhan saw Krishna also. He wanted to kill Krishna. Kamsa saw Krishna. Many people saw Krishna. But Krishna says in the Gita, Abhajananti mammuda manusimantanumasritam param bhavam ajanantu mamat bhuta maheshwaram. There are certain people who, yeah, may see me, but will think I'm just an ordinary person because I have a form, I look human-like, so they may not detect my ontological position as the Absolute. Because sometimes we may just think of the Absolute in terms of who knows what. Sometimes just the exact negation of what we experience in our present human life. So if the present human life is possessed of diversity, form, and relationships and attributes, maybe transcendence should be ideally the opposite of that, so devoid of all that. And there's a point and there is a place, as we will see today, for such a conclusion, for such an aspect of the Absolute. But there is also a place for seeing whatever we are perceiving here as a, sometimes said, perverted reflection of what's ideally found in the ultimate reality. When there is form, but as my Guru Maharaj likes to say, we have the possibility of spiritual form, and a spiritual form is not something that limits, but facilitates. Because sometimes we think of form limits. No? This is the form, so whatever is in the form is limited to the form. But we can say, as my Guru Maharaj would like to say, we are an artist, so we have some latent art inside of us that wants to be expressed. But you need a form for that to happen. You need like so many elements. How do you call this one?
Canvas.
The canvas. You need the canvas and so many forms. So to facilitate the abstract artistic tendency lying within you. So in that sense, form is not limiting your expression, limiting yourself, but facilitating whatever you have so you can be all that you can be. So there is a place for form facilitating in such a way that we can be all that we can be. And that's not, of course, limited to art on this temporary sphere. But it's ultimately related to the ultimate art. And Krishna is known as Kalanidhi, which means he's an ocean of arts. So if you have some artistic tendency, you know where to go. you know where to swim. An ocean of artistry, if that word exists at all. Okay, thank you for the confirmation. So today we will be studying the sixth verse of Brahma Stuti. We already studied the first five and two introduction classes. So today is the eighth session, but the sixth verse we'll be seeing. And interestingly, today's the verse will be speaking about the formless form of the Absolute. No? Which, again, there is a place for that. No? Although in our particular school of thought, we may have this very strong attraction and call, clarion call in the direction of, again, this spiritual form that we feel is facilitating so much of loving exchange and potential. Nonetheless, there is place for a formless form, if you want to put it like that. So we'll speak about that today. But as usual before, I will make a brief recap of what we saw yesterday, which was verse number 5 for those who were not present, and especially for those who were present. So let's see how much you can help me in the recap. And therefore I will realize how much attention you were having in the class. So the fifth verse, basically in the fifth verse that we saw yesterday, Brahmaji was explaining how yoga ultimately bears fruit, whatever fruit one is pursuing with through the yoga practice, by being mixed with bhakti. So that's a very important point made throughout this Brahma Stuti. Not only bhakti is totally crucial for the attainment of Bhagavan, but even if you chose to tread some other path, bhakti is totally like the active principle who will eventually give us whatever desired fruit. Akama sarva kama va moksha kama udaradhi tibrena bhakti yogena jayita purusham param. It is said in the Bhagavatam. Whether you are akama, free from all desires, sarva kama, you have all desires, it's never enough. It's never possible to have all desires, but it's a way of saying that. Moksha kama. Or you have some desire, one desire. I want moksha. I want mukti. For which you have to get rid of all other desires. But that's one desire, which is more powerful than all the other desires put together, because it's beyond those desires. Whatever your situation, tibrena bhakti yogena jayeta purusham param. You just render intense bhakti to the Supreme Person, and whatever you need will come of its own accord. So even if you are after something different from bhakti for its own sake, which is of course what we want, bhakti for its own sake, but if you want something else, whatever the case, bhakti can facilitate that. Even in a more user-friendly way, and relatively easy and quicker way, than trying to thread some other paths with their particular difficulties. But of course, those other paths are there, and Krishna himself is describing them in the Gita and in the Bhagavatam, because also he's God, he's wise, he's omniscient, he knows not everybody will thread the path of bhakti, because don't everybody has full faith in something so easy and simple. That's interesting. If I tell you, no, just by doing this and this, you obtain this, and generally both say, no, it cannot be that easy. But if I say, I have this very complicated thing, okay, let's see, this seems more interesting, more serious, more deep, more high, deeper, higher. And so, okay, there you have other, all these other yoga, jnana, and paths which are there, but are relatively quite more complex. Require lots of preliminary qualification, whether qualification for Bhakti Shraddha, to have faith in Bhakti. But again, some people do not have that faith. Oh, okay. You don't have that faith? Okay, you can practice yoga, but you need some qualification. Brahmacharya, for example. Okay, you don't have faith in how user-friendly Bhakti is? Okay, try the path of yoga. It begins with celibacy. I said, okay. That's not so easy. No? So, but that's the price if you choose not to have faith in Bhakti. Or Gyan Shankara will say, if you want to attain Mukti, you have to accept sannyas at one point. So again, sannyas is not generally a very massive bestseller around people in this world. It's not that I go around the village and trying to, I don't know, open a ministry for sannyas. Now, here is the Swami. Who wants to join me? Who wants to be Swami? Let's travel, just knock on the door, and you know, whatever comes. I don't think I'll be that successful. But anyhow, those options are there. But we have to be realistic about which are those options. Not just take one part and try to make something that is not the actual path. So, still I have not even begun the recap. Sorry for that. I'm making some recap from the previous lectures as well, since some of you come today for the first time. So I'll read yesterday's verse, not yesterday, the day before yesterday, verse number 5. Brahma is saying, O unlimited, infallible Lord, in the past, many yogis in this world offered their prescribed practices and even their worldly actions unto you. As a consequence of thus surrendering their actions unto you, they obtained bhakti in the form of hearing and recounting your narrations. Then, having directly realized the self by such bhakti alone, they easily attained your supreme destination. So, this verse, as we mentioned 2 days ago, is speaking mostly about yogis who started their yoga practice without resorting to bhakti, eventually not being successful in attaining their ultimate desired goal, and thus resorting to bhakti and being successful. And of course, Brahma is here confirming again, not only that if you want to know Krishna, you need bhakti, but if you want to be successful in any other path, at one point you need bhakti also. And there are plenty of scriptural statements to this effect. No? I won't torture you with quote after quote at this moment. Krishna, is named here in this verse. One of the names he's referred to is Achyuta. So Achyuta means?
Infallible.
Okay, infallible. So it has many meanings, but basically here it means Krishna doesn't fail in giving the corresponding result to whomever resorts to bhakti, for whatever reason. Now, even if you are not resorting to bhakti for their deepest reason, you are resorting to bhakti in some way. Krishna is reciprocating with bhakti. It's his own internal being. Krishna says in the Gita, Madat Makaha, bhakti is my heart. Bhakti in person is Sri Radha. So Sri Radha is Krishna's heart, basically. And of course, he's giving bhakti, which protects the practitioner from all failure, basically. Grants all success, protects from all failure at the same time. And bhakti is easy, as we mentioned. Here it is very clearly pointed to. How these yogis resort to bhakti, enter in touch with bhakti? Shravanam kirtanam. By hearing and speaking, starting with hearing. So we emphasize, it's not that difficult. I mean, you have to make some effort to hear, no? Like you are doing today. You have to put gas in the car, open the door, turn on the car, drive for maybe 10, 15 minutes, park the car, get down the car, close the car. Well, you can leave it open. We are here. No? Walk the stairs, sit on the floor. That's all. Here, not here. Compared to, again, go to the cave, practice celibacy, accept sannyas. I think We can make a case for bhaktis, user friendliness, basically. So this verse is making this point here. I mean, these yogis resort to hear about your glories and narrations, and they receive this bhakti. They obtain this bhakti, non-inherent, obtained, received, and they eventually can attain the highest destination. So what's the meaning of the highest destination? It's twofold. On one side, the options that the commentators had given is some yogis want to achieve whatever realization different from Bhagavan. So they mix at one point the practice with bhakti, and they attain that goal that they have in mind, which is not Bhagavan. But for them, subjectively, it's the highest destination. Subjectively speaking, this is the best for them. But objectively speaking, there's highest, which is according to the Bhagavatam, the realization of Bhagavan. So the yogis will obtain that when they are practicing their yoga, they mix their yoga with bhakti, and when mixing, invoking bhakti in their life, they become so much called and attracted to bhakti that then fully choose to tread the path of bhakti. Because they come to this conclusion, okay, if I'm practicing karma, jnana, yoga, and I, in all of those cases, I need bhakti, so my practice is successful. So what if I only practice bhakti? You follow? Bhakti is so powerful that all other practices require it to give success. What if I exclusively go to bhakti? How much powerful will that be? What will be attained through that? So some yogis will get in that direction and attain what is objectively the highest destination, which in this case, Brahma is after. Brahma is a great yogi, remember, at the beginning of creation, just sitting in this lotus and meditating for eons. I mean, that's not so easy, no? Looking for his source and eventually having all these revelations where Krishna appears. So this shows how the ultimate fruit of yoga is such a darshan. So Brahma is a great yogi, and he wants to attain Krishna in Vrindavan as a friend. Confirmed there. It's everything properly orchestrated. We were rehearsing for 2 weeks with that person. So when I said this, so it was worthy the time of practicing. Anyhow, so objectively speaking, again, some yogis will attain the highest destination, which again, according to the Bhagavatam, is Krishna in Vrindavan, and some other yogis by obtaining whatever, Brahman or Santarasa in Vaikuntha, whatever the goal, will be the highest destination according to their subjective desire, no? Aspiration, basically. So today, we'll start with today's verse now. This verse will further clarify all the points that have been said in the previous verses. No? And in this particular case, Brahma will make the case how, although some of these yogis attain their respective goals, not Bhagavan, but whatever other goals they wish to attain through bhakti, nonetheless, the attainment of the devotee, the attainment of the person who exclusively chooses bhakti is, objectively speaking, superior. Again, subjectively speaking, that's another thing. Subjectively speaking, there is place for diversity. No? Like we can say, yes, I like to give the example, I don't know. Objectively speaking, the sweetest fruit is mango. I think so. Maybe it's another one. I don't know if there is some experiment. But let's say it's mango. So it has been scientifically proved that objectively speaking, the sweetest fruit is mango. Okay, but some of you may say, but Swami, I like oranges more than that. And someone say, but that's not the sweetest. Yeah, I know. But that's the sweetest for me. That's what I like the most. So subjectively speaking, oranges are the best. The sweetest for me. Objectively speaking, mango is the topmost. You follow my point? So, Isaac, nice to see you. So, again, in the same way, we can say objectively speaking, there's a way to establish a gradation in revelations of aspects of the Absolute. Although subjectively speaking, every person will feel, this is the best. And as Krishna Das Kaviraj Goswami says, if you feel like that in connection to the Absolute, we are speaking here about the Absolute, not any other nonsense you can do. Oh, I feel killing other people is the best for me. No, we are not supporting that type of subjectivity. But in connection to the Absolute, that's another category. So everyone will feel, oh, this connection with the Absolute is the best. And everyone will be correct, subjectively speaking. And so we are not here in a crusade for trying to, you know, bring everyone to our subjective affinity for the Absolute or whatever. Although it may be objectively proved, like Krishna and Vrindavan, there is place for respect, appreciation, and nourishing from diversity. So, that said, again, Brahma in this verse will establish the objective superiority of the attainment of the Ananya Bhakta, which means the devotee who has Ananya. Ananya means other, and Ananya means no other. So Ananya means other, like separate interest, other. Ananya means free from all separate interest. Ananya vilasita sunya. Ananya. So, let's go to the verse. Number 6. This is in Bamsashtavilam Chanda. The meter of the verse is Bamsashtavilam.
Tata pibhumam mahima gunasyate bibodhumarhatyamalantaratma bihi abhi kriyatshanubhavadarupatum yananya bodhyatmatayana chanyata.
So I'll read the translation. Brahma is praying here to Krishna, just in case. And as much as you can, try to remember which is the whole context and the emotional situation of Brahma after what he saw, after his vimohan, forehead spinning, with his head on the ground offering pranam to Krishna, crying, very, very moved by discovering a new face of his Ishtadev. O infinite being, non-devotees, however, in connection to the other verse, of course, he just said, yogis can attain you, and so on. And all infinite being, non-devotees, however, cannot realize you in your full personal feature. Nevertheless, it may be possible for them to realize your expansion as the impersonal supreme by cultivating direct perception of the self within the heart. But they can do this only by purifying their mind and senses of all conceptions of material distinctions and all attachment to material sense and objects. Only in this way will your impersonal feature manifest itself to them. So as we mentioned, today's topic mainly will be the formless form of the Absolute. Mm-hmm. How to attain it? And as it is mentioned here in the beginning, that doesn't include the personal feature of the Absolute. While when we speak about realizing the personal feature of the Absolute, that includes the impersonal feature. So I'll briefly repeat mention the word-by-word meaning of every term in this verse. The verse starts saying tatapi. So tata-api means nevertheless or however, connecting with the previous statement. Bhuman. Bhuman, remember what does it mean? Or I don't know if it was here in Kansas that we read this verse. Too much traveling. Bhuman is all infinite, or limited being, basically. Mahima. Mahima means glory or greatness. Mahimaha means big. So Mahima means biggerness or something like this. Agunasya. Agunasya means he who of him who has no guna. Him who has no material qualities. Guna means quality. Te means of you. Bibodhum arahati. One who is able, arahati of bibodhum. Bibodhum means understand. Like buddhi means intelligence. So vibodham means understand. Amala means spotless or pure without any tinge of contamination. Anta atma vihi, with mind and senses. So with mind and senses free from all tinge of contamination, someone may understand your form devoid of qualities. Abhikriyat, not based on material differentiations. You have to enter into that frequency to connect impersonal feature of the Absolute. Swa anubhavat, by perception of the soul or the Supreme Soul, depending the type of interpretation. Now we'll see how all these verses lend itself to different layers of meaning. Arupataha, which means without attachment to material forms. Again, this is a little the adhikar for someone who can realize impersonal feature, as we mentioned. No attachment, no perception of the differentiation in the mind, and so on. He means indeed. Ananya bodhya atmataya. As self-manifested without the help of any other illuminating agent. That's how this will take place. We will explain all this. Nacha anjata. But not otherwise. In other words, there is a very specific way of realizing this feature of the Absolute. And again, there's considerable risk of not reaching that realization if one is not treading the proper path to that. Which is, again, not that much user-friendly, as Krishna himself says in the Gita. Klesha dikatarashte sam abhyakta ashakta cheta sam abhyakta hikatir dukam dihavad viravapite. Those who have their minds attached to the unmanifest aspect of the Absolute, they undergo considerable tribulation. It's not an easy task. Let's before going to the elder commentators on the Bhagavatam on this verse, I'll share, as I've been doing these days, a little short, in this case, commentary by my Guru Maharaj on this verse. He has written a whole commentary on each of these verses in his forthcoming book, and he has been generous enough to share that with me, to share so I can be generous with you by his generosity. So I will share what he has shared. It's called Bhaktivedanta Bhavanubad, or a transmission of the spirit of the different commentaries on this verse. He's giving like that in his own mode and words. So in his previous Bhavanubad, Guru Maharaj is mentioning again, yogis attain their goals by mixing their yoga practice with bhakti. So now he says, however, by mixed bhakti, the yogis do not attain the same experience of Krishna's sweetness and charming qualities that his unalloyed devotees do, which is what Brahma is longing for. Remember, there's a focus in Brahma, so it's always important to, if you are studying the prayers of Brahma, it's important to know where Brahma's prayers are pointing to. No? Although some other people may be pointing in that direction, it's also important to keep the context in mind. So Brahma is pointing to this sweet, charming, personal feature of the Absolute as Krishna in Vrindavan, as the friend. So he's making this point in the context of expressing his own attraction, as we mentioned. He's making all these philosophical points to further establish in himself what he's wanting to attain. Okay, I want to attain this. So which are the implications of desiring this goal? So you have all these Brahma Stuti, 40 prayers. So the yogis do not attain this sweet and charming aspect that the devotees attain. Typically, they attain Krishna's aura of Nirvishesh Brahman, which, as we mentioned, we can call it form that has no form, or the formless form of the Absolute. While some may realize one of his qualities, such as his compassion, but not like the fullest of his personality. So again, as we already mentioned, I think here, 2 days ago, there's a difference between what sometimes we call Brahmavad and Mayavad. These are, sometimes the terms can be used differently, but generally they are presented in this context. So Brahmavad means someone who wants to attain Brahman, but is not considering Krishna's form as illusory, is not offending bhakti, is acknowledging the necessity of mixing their practice with bhakti, and eventually is attaining that Brahman forever, for eternity. That's their goal. So those called Brahmavadis. On the other side, Mayavadis are sometimes considered those who offend bhakti in the form of considering only Brahman is real, the form of Bhagavan is illusory, is temporary, bhakti is not necessary, and through all these type of things, even if by their own practice they attain the stage of Jivan Mukti, which means to be liberated in this body, still, it's a quote-unquote liberation, still they have to get rid of the prarabdha karma of having this body. When they leave this body, that's called videha mukti or atyantika mukti. if they happen to offend bhakti, they can even fall from that almost liberated position of jivan mukti. That's what the Bhagavatam is saying. Janiera vindaksha vimukta maninas toyasta bhavata avishuddha buddhaya. Anyhow. So, but those who are, again, the Brahmavadis, they do not reject bhakti. They actually reject jnana at one point, because jnana is of the nature of sattva. That's mentioned in the Gita, that's mentioned in the Bhagavad. So the jnanis embrace jnana to the point that it helps them to get closer and closer to their ultimate realization, but at that point they have to reject jnana as well and invoke bhakti to enter, to access Brahma Sayuja. So the Mayavadis reject bhakti and fall. The Brahmavadis reject sattva and accept bhakti and attain Brahma Sayuja by bhakti's grace. So that's the conclusion of Shastra. Anyhow, some words regarding my Guru Maharaj's Bhavanubad. Let's go to what our ancient commentators have to say. Sridhar Swami, Srila Sanatana Goswami, Srila Jiva Goswami, and so on. This may take some time today. I hope you have eternity available. So, there we go. So let's begin with Sridhar Swami, who is generally for us as Gaudiyas, like the ancient commentator par excellence, especially venerated by Mahaprabhu. I'm sorry if today's topic is not so tasty as speaking about Gadadhar Pandit and all the things that we spoke yesterday, but it's also an intricate, important topic to understand, to have as proper foundation, so we can not misread the higher realities that our tradition also is giving. So Sridhar Swami, let's go to Sridhar Swami Bhavartha Deepika commentary. He's paraphrasing Brahma, as most of the commentators do. So they paraphrase Brahma in their own words, and through that they give their commentary. So far, it has been stated that knowledge of both aspects, personal and impersonal, sometimes called saguna and nirguna, with attributes, without attributes, so far it has been established that knowledge of these both aspects is difficult to achieve. None of them is actually easy, like cheap bargain or something. And that you, Brahma is saying to Krishna, you can be realized only by the process of hearing or narrating a discourse about you, as we say today. No? Just make all this effort to enter the car and come here and hear Harikatha. Now, although these two different kinds of knowledge were said to be difficult to fathom without making a distinction between them, till now there was not a distinction made which is more difficult or something like that. It's just say it's not easy to realize the absolute, whether in nirgun or sagun aspects. Nonetheless, it is possible to gain some knowledge of the supreme reality beyond all qualities, nirguna, but not of you, Brahma is saying to Krishna, the supreme with transcendental qualities, sagun, because your qualities are inconceivable and unlimited. So you are called arupataha because you are not an object of perception. So here Brahma, or Sridhar Swami, through Brahma, is making an interesting point. No? Because till now we say, okay, bhakti is very user-friendly, and so on, and processes like jnana are more hard. But now he's saying apparently like the opposite thing. Not the opposite, but he's saying to conceive the absolute in impersonal terms is comparatively easier than to conceive Krishna. Of course, we might say, no, it's easier Krishna. No, that's easy because you got sadhu sangha, because you enter in touch with Shastra by bhakti. But without that, nobody will reach that conclusion. Now, I think the absolute is a bluish boy who plays a flute in a forest in bucolic village, and he has this loving interaction. It's not happening. So for that, we need divine intervention, divine descent. While we can reach through our own, by our own strength, the conclusion, the ultimate aspect of divinity is without qualities. Because here are qualities, as we said, there, here is form, here is this. So the opposite of that must be ultimate reality. We can reach that conclusion. In that sense, it's easier to conceive the nirguna. But to conceive the saguna aspect, like an absolute which has form, again, because for us absolute means unlimited, transcendental form. How can be form and absolute be at this? How can you have an unlimited form? No? That's interesting in itself. That's what's happening with the Damodar Lila. No? That's totally astonishing. No? Even Yashoda was astonished from her own vantage point. So, you know, she was trying to bind Krishna. And Krishna was like, there, like an ordinary child, like crying, actually. Why are you binding me? Like an ordinary boy. I mean, the most ordinary thing you can imagine, if you will, in one sense. A child crying, and no, I didn't do anything. Why are you doing this to me? I will have to do therapy when I'm grown. I have to go to Aradhana to have therapy. This is trauma for me. All this type of show. No, not show. I mean, he was really doing, but like, so the whole village was coming, what's going on here? Oh, and just was trying to tie Krishna to the mortar. And as we know, she was trying to tie always two fingers too short. So she was bringing more rope, or yeah, whatever, silken rope, not like the very heavy one.
Soft.
Yeah, soft, silken. So adding that, still two fingers too short. Two fingers too short. And it's not that Krishna's body was expanding. You follow? Because if Krishna is expanding, okay, yeah, I need more rope. But Krishna remained the same size. But the rope, there was more and more rope, but they were always the same. So that's this type of idea of, no? Unlimited form. The form is the same. There is form. It doesn't expand, according to our eyes. But no matter how much you try to measure it or tie it, it's not possible. It keeps expanding. Because you say, I mean, I keep expanding my rope, and it's never enough. So that means the form keeps expanding. But at the same time, the form is not keep expanding. So Vimohan, another type of Vimohan. So again, this is not so easy to understand. For this, we need to adopt another type of method to address such a reality. So yeah, Krishna has form, has name, has qualities, but none of them are mundane. They are totally beyond our sense mental capacity. Atashri Krishna namadi nababrit grahyam indriyai chibon mukhi jibado swayam eva spuratyada, says Rupa Goswami. Name, form, qualities of Krishna cannot be grasped by the gross mundane senses. Chibon mukhi jibado swayam eva spuratyada. But when one engages those same limited senses with an attitude of seva, of giving oneself for the pleasure of Krishna, all those senses start to facilitate the experience of Krishna. Without that proper aptitude, all those senses are being interfering with the experience of Krishna. But if properly used, those same senses are giving us access, no? Starting with the tongue, Rupa Goswami is saying, no? By speaking about Krishna, no? Chanting about Krishna, and why not honoring prasad? So in that sense, we could say Saguna Brahman, or the Absolute with qualities, in this sense I mean by that Saguna Brahman, there are other ways of explaining that, is most difficult to understand than Nirguna Brahman, for most at least. So this is what Sridhar Swami is mentioning. Let's go to Srila Sanatana Goswami's Brihad Vaishnava Toshani, his commentary, which is called For the Pleasure of the Vaishnavas. So I hope you derive some delight from it. So he shares the implication of this verse again by paraphrasing Brahma. And in this way we will see that in all these verses Brahma is trying to establish the glories of bhakti and praising bhakti. Sometimes he will do that directly, ambaya. Sometimes he will do that indirectly, vyatireka. Like by implying the superiority of bhakti directly, or how other processes depend on bhakti for their success and all this type of thing, which indirectly points to bhakti. So from two sides of the coin, we are trying to address the same idea. So Sanatana Goswami paraphrases Brahma, saying, "You are endowed with many qualities. The glory of even one of your qualities cannot be understood in truth." Indeed, the next verse, of a Brahma Stuti, Brahma will continue developing this idea, no? How impossible it is to grasp even one of your qualities, or to speak of all, quote unquote all. I mean, if he's unlimited, how can you say all? We have to get used to this idea. All of Krishna's qualities, but you cannot count them. No. But he's saying, even one of your qualities is unlimited. You have unlimited qualities, and each one of those unlimited qualities is unlimited. And remember, Brahma is the smartest guy in the whole cosmos. No? Pretty, the highest scientist of creation. Four heads, thinking north, south, east, west. And at this point, again, four heads are totally spinning, totally bewildered. Like, what's going on here? No, this is too much. I cannot even grasp one single of your qualities. Or, now comes the or of Sanatana Goswami, like four of them will come. So he gives some level of interpretation of the verse and then will propose another layer of meaning, another layer of meaning. He said, or. So let's go to the first or. And another deeper layers will relate more and more directly to bhakti. Or, given that the glory of bhakti is such, even if one has the topmost endeavor for jnana, that person will not acquire knowledge of you, who are vast ocean of infinite illustrious qualities, but perhaps someone can have some understanding of the glory of one quality of yours. In this case, one quality of yours refers to Bhagavan's aspect of Nirvishesh Brahma, which again, in order to grasp Brahman, you need bhakti. Without bhakti, there is no success in any path. With bhakti, we can grasp. And Brahman is considered one aspect, if you want to call it, the one quality of Bhagavan, which again is unlimited also. Or, Sanatana Goswami says, one should understand the manifold excellence of the glory of your qualities, especially your quality of compassion. Or there's another or, I counted wrongly. No. So here he speaks about the compassion of Bhagavan, and in connection to that, he now makes a quantum leap and starts to glorify Sri Radha. In connection to compassion, no, she's Karuna Mayi, she's the merciful nature of the Godhead, the goddess. In connection to compassion, he says the glory, Mahi, here the word Mahima is mentioned. So again, Sanskrit lends itself to unlimited interpretations. If you have a taste for that, a capacity for that, you will be able to find so much there. So Sanatana Goswami is mining all this potential here. So he said, the glory of your quality as Radha, Mahima. Mahi means glory, and Ma is a way of referring to Radha. It's a name for Lakshmi, and Radha is the original Lakshmi. So the glory of your quality as Radha, if you want to call her a quality, if you will, no? His Shakti personified, deserves to be understood. So you can see, no? I mean, you can take this verse as speaking about Brahman on one level, or this topic rather deserves to be understood by you. And of course, we know how you will understand such a goddess. It's not just, okay, I'll try to figure her out. No? There's a very unique way of doing that. And interestingly, here, Sanatana Goswami said, okay, Brahma is implying this to Krishna, but Krishna at this point is just about to enter Poganda age. So in Poganda Lila, he still is not having romantic situation with Sri Radha. So Sanatana Prabhu says, though Krishna was still a child at this point of the in the Prakat Lila, we are on the Lila on earth, this can be stated in relation to his eternal pastime. Because again, at this point, his relationship with Radha is not officially consummated in the chronological unfolding of the earth Lila. But Nitya Kishore, Nitya, no? in the Nitya Vrindavan, he's eternally youthful, eternally adolescent, eternally in love with Radha. Or, Sanatana Goswami continues, your glory can be especially understood by the quality of mercy. That's another way of saying, no? By your mercy, your real, ultimate glory can be, or any of your glories, or any of your qualities can be understood by your mercy. Like another way of saying, bhakti is your mercy, because in order to receive bhakti in your life, that's another way of saying receiving causeless mercy, because bhakti comes to our lives, jadrichaya, the Bhagavatam says, because of the mercy of the merciful devotees of Bhagavan. They are the Kripa Shakti of Bhagavan. The Bhaktas are the representatives of the agency of causeless grace of God in this world. So, Bhakti is another way of speaking about God's mercy. And remember, Brahma is saying this here. Brahma is walking the talk in the form of... he's having deep insight. He's receiving... in this moment, he's feeling, I'm receiving such undeserved grace. I'm receiving such darshan. And what did I do to deserve this? Better I do not ask that. No. I will put in jail if I ask God too loud. They will hear me and say, oh, no, you didn't come. No. Don't forget the context in which Brahma is praying. Brahma is having direct experience here of Krishna's Karuna Sindhu. He's an unlimited ocean, fathomless ocean of mercy. Why? Remember, what did Brahma do in order to have Krishna's darshan? It's not that he did nothing. Worse than that. He offended the form of Krishna. He engaged in aparadha. He saw the form of Krishna and thought, who is this guy? No, in the picnic with his friends, eating with left hand, totally informal. This cannot be God. This cannot be my guru who is at the beginning of creation. So I'll show that to the world. He's an imposter. So he tried to kidnap his Krishna's friends, Krishna's cops. Thought that he did. And eventually, now he's realizing, as Bhakti Rao says, oh my Krishna. Oh my God. I offended Bhagavan. I offended the form of Bhagavan. Such a divine form. The perfection of all forms. I thought, this is fake. Fake news. I tried to show that to the world. And I engaged in the worst possible type of offense. How Krishna reacted to that worst possible thing? He's giving me his darshan in a very merciful way. So, Brahma is in that moment now. It's in, from that place all these prayers are coming. Don't lose sight of the of the emotional backdrop of these prayers. No. Try to enter yourself in the shoes of Brahma. Try to imagine what's the worst possible thing you can do. And I'm sure that worst possible thing is not as worse as what Brahma did, in one sense. And what's the best thing you could receive? Probably you also are not thinking as what Brahma is receiving. So those two extremes are collapsing now in this single moment, and Krishna and Brahma is realizing, I did the worst possible thing, and I'm receiving the greatest possible mercy. When I deserve it the least, as we say, that's the logic of causeless grace. Help me when I deserve it the least, because that's when I need it the most. So Brahma was in a pretty needy situation, and Krishna realized that, so... okay, here I am. Srila Sanatana Goswami makes one last remark here, mentioning that here we are speaking about Krishna's qualities, like mercy and so on. He makes a point that we are speaking about the Absolute. So in the Absolute, the Absolute is Absolute. His form is Absolute, his qualities are Absolute. So that means there's no difference between him. As we spoke some verses ago in Kansas, Brahma was referring to Krishna as saying, you are this, something like, you are this form. You, this form. He's not saying, you, Krishna, have this form. Because Krishna is his form. Krishna is his body. We are not this body once, but Krishna is his body. Because between him and his body, there's no difference. Between him and his name, Abhinatvam Namanami, no. There's no difference. That was it. What it means to be absolute. Absolute means there's nothing separate from that. Non-dual absolute. So he has a form. And he has qualities in this case. So he's the same as his qualities, interestingly. And the same applies again with his name, with his form, with his lila. So Brahma, the point is Brahma is realizing all the things. Brahma is having one... Every verse of this Brahma Stuti is like a new epiphany that Brahma is having, like a new level of realization concerning the object of his bhakti, you know, his Vishaya Lambana, the object of his longing. Oh, new insight. Oh, this. Oh, so each verse represents that in so many layers. And Sanatana Goswami concludes quoting Jamunacharya from Stotra Ratna, verse 19, says in this connection, having surmised, okay, sorry, I'm practicing my English with all of you, having surmised a series of persons who are sequentially more elevated than the previous one, the words of the Vedas again and again multiply, desiring to continue the sequence beyond Brahma in order to reach the limit of only one of your qualities, but they can only keep trying. One of many ways of trying to make this point. No? Like, only one of your qualities, the Vedas are like, keep trying. Ekshate nashabda, ekshate nashabda, says Vedanta Sutra, means regarding the absolute, we cannot say anything. Or another way of putting it is, we can never say enough. But we'll try to say as much as we can, and that will give meaning to our life. Let's go to Srila Jiva Goswami and fasten your seatbelts, because here comes a very interesting commentary. Very terse one, so also fasten your head. So he says different things. Srila Jiva Goswami, his Lagu Vaishnava Toshani, his commentary on the Bhagavatam. He begins remarking what was already mentioned in previous verses, Gyan Prayasu Dapasyana Manta Eva. Devotees, exclusive devotees, completely give up all effort for Gyan, for separate Gyan, for knowledge devoid of bhakti, separate from bhakti. It's not that our practice is devoid of every type form of Gyan. Actually, we culture Sambandha Gyan, which is actually part of bhakti. We educate ourselves in connection to who we are, who is our source, and what's the link and connection and relationship among us too. So, but Jiva Goswami is going back to this point, which is pretty important. Try to engage in bhakti without it being encumbered by gyan. Gyan sunya bhakti, in the words of Srila Siddhar Maharaj. Brain dead bhakti. Be careful that your head gets in the way of your heart, basically, he's saying. Or in the words of our Guru Maharaj, try to use your head in order to soften your heart. But don't try to soften your heart without using your head. Because that's easy also. You can end up being just emotional and sentimentalist. And, oh, my heart is melting like butter. It's just your mind. So we want emotion. The goal of bhakti, bhakti in itself is an emotion. And the goal of bhakti, in one sense, is bhava, prem, is a very emotional thing. But in order to attain that emotion, we need a whole grounding of philosophy, of tattva, siddhanta. So bhava is a philosophical emotion. It's an emotion which has philosophy at its foundation. It's not just, okay, let's become emotional, let's sing a little bit and let's feel something all together. It's not like that. No. We sing a little bit something, but we try to to ground ourselves in a proper understanding. So what we feel is coming from the right place in connection to the right object. So Jiva Goswami mentions, yes, devotees are interested in that. However, some of these verses from the Brahma Stuti also will explain some result for gyanis and other yogis and practitioners. Like, again, by way of comparison, directly, indirectly, pointing and bhakti by describing other processes. So interestingly, in his Bhagavad Sandarbha, because Jiva Goswami has not only one commentary to the Bhagavatam, we could say he has like three or four, because the whole Sandarbhas are a commentary. He has a seventh Sandarbha called Kram Sandarbha, another commentary. He has Lagu Vaishnava Toshani, another. We see how our Goswamis love the Bhagavatam. No? They finish their commentary, let's write another commentary on the Bhagavatam. No? It's never enough, not like when Srila Prabhupada. So our Guru Maharaj narrates, he concluded his commentary on the Gita, and someone asked, so what book do you plan to write next? He said, maybe I can write a commentary on the Gita. And the Buddha was like, you just published one. And Prabhupada chuckled, like, I mean, one? What's one commentary to the Gita? And there's no end to what you can say. So in his Bhagavad Sandarbha, Jiva Goswami says that according to the specific qualification and disposition of the spiritual aspirant, where's the accent? Aspirant? The absolute truth will reveal itself accordingly, basically, in a specific way. But this is an important point over and over made in our tradition. According to how you approach the absolute will reciprocate. You will face a particular side of it. It's like a multifaceted jewel that according to how you approach it will shed some particular light and color depending which is your approach. I mean, the absolute remains the absolute. But how you approach it, that will take you to a particular experience of it. And this is not only applicable in connection to bhaktas and jnanis, for example, like Bhagavan, Brahman, but among bhaktas itself. You can approach the absolute in terms of Krishna bhakti, Vishnu bhakti, Ram bhakti, the same absolute but different faces, as Guru Maharaj will say. All depending on our approach. Again, the absolute is the absolute. And it has his ultimate form. So we try to explain why in the form of Sri Krishna and Sri Gauranga Dev. But according to how we approach it, he will take different forms. So here again, Jiva Goswami makes this same point made as before by Sanatana Goswami. Brahman, when we can understand the idea of Brahman here as a quality of Bhagavan. In other words, Bhagavan being the full face of the Absolute, Brahman being one of its attributes, that is perceived according to a particular approach. A classical example is sun, God, sun, planet, sun, rays. The three things are the sun. You cannot just like, now the sun rays are entering. So I can say, oh, the sun has come to the room. And you say, yes. But also at the same time, the sun has not entered the room. Because if not, class is over. And all of us as well. So the sun entered but did not enter. Yes? Makes sense?
Yeah.
But it's not contradictory? Entered and not entered? Even with the material phenomena, you can make sense of that. What to speak of? So again, the sun... planet is one thing, the sun rays are one, but they are connected in between themselves. And what to speak, the sun god. Or as we gave a more contemporary example the other day, subway. Now you are in the subway station, waiting for the subway, and you look into the tunnel. You are in a rush, and subway is not coming, so you are looking into the tunnel. And first thing, if the subway is actually coming, what's the first thing you see? You see a light. I mean, the subway is there, the people in the subway is there, but you just see the light. That's the particular approach from which you are addressing that reality. But eventually, you see the wagon, you say wagon?
Train.
The different?
The cars.
The cars? Mm-hmm. Okay, of the subway. So, okay, that's a more specified. The light is there also, you see the light, but now you see, and when it gets even closer and the doors open, there's people there. I can enter, we can interact. Still the car is there, the light is there. It's not that I stop seeing them, but now, this much more dynamic reality is there. This is the subway 2.0, if you will. The totality of the subway now is perceived. No? But again, the absolute can be, again, I don't want to compare the absolute with the subway, with all respect, it's just an analogy. So according to how we approach, from which perspective we try to address, we will find these different phases. So Mahima, in this verse, the word Mahima, Jiva Goswami says, which again means glory or greatness, one level of interpretation it refers to Brahman. Because Mahima also means greatness. And that's the very definition of Brahman given in the Shruti, in the scriptures. Brahman is that which is great, powerful, or expansive, and which makes others great, powerful, and expansive. Brimhati, brimhayati, iti Brahma. And that's the very meaning of Brahman, the great. Because, it's an all-pervading light. I mean, to say great sounds even like limiting to something that has no all-pervading. How great is that? So, there is a possibility again. Let's spend some minutes before concluding with some ideas about the possibility of realizing Brahman, which again is not the the pursuit of our particular school of thought, but it's a possibility nonetheless. So this realization is possible because between Brahman and the Jiva, to begin with, no? Let's begin on some common ground. There is some common characteristic, if you will, of being conscious. We are consciousness. Brahman is conscious by nature as well. So that's a very meeting point through which you can eventually attain this form of identification with that reality, if you want to put it in some word. Because we don't consider that their actual merging is there, as we will explain. But again, for us to attain that, still you require the grace of God. Again, you require the intervention of bhakti. Krishna says in the Gita, Brahma Bhuta Prasadatmana Sochati Nakakshati Sama Sarveshu Bhutesu Madhvaktim Lavati Param. So I'm the foundation of Brahman, he says. Krishna Bhagavan is speaking and says, Brahma Bhuta Prasadatma. So he's saying, I'm the foundation of Brahman and Madhvaktim Lavati Param. Through bhakti, someone can attain that Brahman. So for us, Brahman is a different idea of what the followers of Shankaracharya, for example, refer as Brahman. That's an important point. When we say Brahman, we are not referring to the same Brahman that the Advaita Vadis are referring to. So for us, the Brahman is the Brahman that, for example, Srila Vyasadev witnessed in divine trance when he composed the Bhagavatam. He realized Brahman. I mean, he has direct sakshat experience of Brahman, of that radical, non-dual, undifferentiated aspect of the Absolute. He had that realization. That's why he said in the Bhagavatam, Brahmeti paramatmeti bhagavani tu shabdite. The Absolute can be appreciated in terms of Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. He's seeing. Whatever he's saying, he's seeing. That's the important point. It's not that Vyasadeva just started to, let's see how I can feel this last line, which word can I use? Let's see. No. He's just sharing what he's witnessing. what he's seeing, he's writing, if you will. So, for us, Brahman is that Brahman, which is the Brahman who is described in the Upanishads, in the Vedanta Sutra, and Shastra in general. I'm seen by Vyasadeva and described also in the Bhagavatam. But for us, the Brahman that is described by the Advaita Vadis is not a Brahman that is basically according to what Shastra is saying. Because Advaita Vadis will say, again, only Brahma Satya Jagat Mithya. Everything is false except Brahman. Even Bhagavan is false, bhakti is false, ultimately. We can use that at some point as a tool to eventually reject and merge into Brahman. So that's not the conclusion of Shastra. That's not the conclusion of the Bhagavatam, as I mentioned before. In the Bhagavatam, Brahma, the devas led by Brahma say, Janera Vindakshavi Muktamaninas. If you think yourself liberated in Gyan, but you offend bhakti and reject Bhagavan, you fall from that position. You don't attain Brahma Sayuja. Which is one form of mukti again. We accept. That's mukti. Mukti means permanent residence in transcendence. You cannot fall from there. If you attain that, you cannot fall. If not, you cannot call it mukti. Sometimes devotees tell me, there are sometimes devotees who think that you fall from Brahman if you attain it first. But how can you fall from something that has been called mukti? The very word mukti, muktirhi tvanyata arupam sarupina vyavyashtitihi, says the Bhagavatam. Mukti means you are totally free from all types of illusion and influences from maya shakti, and you are situated in your eternal nature. So how can you fall from that? If you fall from that, it cannot be called mukti. But the Bhagavatam is mentioned, there are five types of mukti, and one of them is ekatvam, or Sayuja, this. So, how does this realization occur? No? Jiva Goswami, and this verse of the Bhagavatam briefly mentions that. No, first, the yogi realizes the pure self. The word Swanubhavat in this verse can be taken up to that. No? And then the yogi comes to realize Brahman. Again, we are here speaking about the yogi who is not rejecting bhakti, who is attracted to Brahman for a particular association and some scars he has received, she has received. So, first there is realization of oneself as an Atma, and then of Brahman. Atmananda, Brahmananda. And then, an objection is presented by the commentators, as usual, to make their presentation even stronger. So the idea is, but when you perceive an object in this world, let's start here, with your senses, basically, the process of perception in itself produces a change in our main mental state. Sorry if I become too technical, but I have to. Yogic language. So that's called vritti. Vritti means sometimes like wave. So like mental wave. So you perceive something with your senses, that creates some modification in your subtle psychic organ. And the mind is subtle but still material. And it's subject to transformation. The mind is like elastic, if you want to put it somewhere. No? It adapts and transforms and mutates like matter. No? This body is not, it's never the same. It takes so many forms. So psychic matter even has much more possibilities, no? Than the gross one. Because you may like to change your body here and you can do some surgery and try to make your nose change and that. Till some point, no? If you do too much, it won't look that well. But in your psychic world, body, you can just like do so many things that you can even do here. You will like to jump from the window and fly like that bird. Better don't try it in this lifetime. It won't end nice physically. But mentally, you can travel whenever you want. So there's much more elasticity. Okay, there. So the question is, if the mind is subject to transformation, how one, that person, can perceive the pure self, the Atman or Brahman, which are free from transformation? Because generally we know to perceive something, we do that through the medium of the mind, and the mind is subject to transformation. So how to perceive something which is devoid of transformation, which is fixed, as Krishna mentioned in the Gita, changeless? Always fixing one permanent reality. So Brahma is using here the word abhikriyat, which means actually the knowledge of the pure self, of the experience of who we are as Atma, arises to begin with the mind is free from all vrittis. So Brahma is saying, yes, I agree. If there are vrittis in your mind, you cannot perceive the self, what to speak of Brahman. So first your mind has to be free from all breathing, free from all movements, has to attain complete, calmness. Like a lake, sometimes the example is given, not like a lake which has no movement and is no breathing, no waves, no movement. Again, this is most of the idea of the jnani. For the bhaktas, my gurus will say the same analogy of the lake plays itself out differently. We have the lake, and you throw a stone in the lake and it creates, ripples. So it's nice, but if you start to throw many stones in different places, one ripple is like killing the other, basically. So it's chaotic, it's not beautiful. So that's basically material life, material mind, no? Separate interests. One stone here, one ripple there, and it's like chaotic, it's not harmonic. You will say, oh, how nice will it be to have calm lake mind. Calm lake-like mind. But the bhakta will say, but there's another option. It's nice to have a calm lake, but also we can throw a stone to the lake, but we can keep throwing stones always to the same point in the lake. So it will create just an expansion of the same original ripple. It's not conflicting ripples, conflicting mind waves, but always, no, investing ourselves in the center, if you will. Watering the root. Bhakti means that. And that will create an expanded sense of harmony. Movement, but harmonious movement, not conflicting movement. I'm mentioning all this to appreciate the differences even in transcendence. Some will like to eternally reside in a calm lake, and some others will like the harmony and variety coming from that type of movement. But here, of course, again, Brahma is referring to this. If you want to perceive the Atma and Brahman through your mind, first your mind has to be free from all vrittis or movements. Has to enter basically samadhi. Has to be in trance. So trance means no movement.
Citta vritti yoga, citta vritti nirodha, says Patanjali in the beginning of his sutras. Yoga means citta vritti nirodha, vritti, the word there, no? To stop all movements in the mind. So when you stop all this mind waving, waves, you will be able to perceive reality without filters, if you will. But again, without much influence of bhakti either. So there's a level of pure perception, yeah. But then the Goswami say, well, okay, we agree with that, but we have a further objection to add to that. Because experience, if you speak about experience, experience is generally related to an object. No, we experience something else. Someone, something. But the Atma is described in the Gita as intangible, basically. Like as far as the senses are concerned. I mean, with the senses, you cannot just like smell, touch, see the Atma. It's not happening. So in that sense, we cannot say that the Atma is an object of experience. Because the self exists in, how to say, non-spatial space, non-measurable, non-observable dimension. Interestingly, but yet it's pervading one single body. No, the Atma. It's not necessarily, I'm not in your body and so on. I'm not aware of what's going on there. Thanks so much. I have enough with my vehicle. So, in reply to this objection, Brahma uses the word arupata here. So arupata refers to, again, when the mind is free from the vrittis, from these waves, basically movements that are generated from attachments to different objects of this plane, related to gross bodies, to subtle bodies, then the self becomes manifest. So basically that's the idea. No, it's not that you need an object. No, when you are free yourself from all these mind movements, who you are, the Atma, just appears by its own accord, becomes manifest. The example sometimes given is the light bulb. Is it bulb? Light bulb. So you do not need a separate source of illumination to see the light bulb. No external light is required. No external condition is required to shed light on the light bulb. The light bulb, if you will, is self-effulgent. No? So in that same sense, we could say the Atma is self-effulgent. By its own light, which is not a bulb light, you will reach to perceive that. You will get to perceive that. Again, according to Srila Jiva Goswami, in our bhakti tradition, according to Shastra, in order for all this to happen, perception of the Atma, perception of Brahman, bhakti is required. Because if not, in order for the mind to be free from the influence of attachments and gunas, bhakti is required. Krishna says in the Gita, what? Daibi hirsha gunamai. Mamamaya duratyaya mameva ye prapadyante mamameva mayameva last line please. Mayameva tarantite. I'm mixing two lines or what? Daibi hirsha gunamai mamamaya duratyaya mameva ye prapadyante mayametam tarantite. Yeah. Long time since I didn't quote that verse. So Krishna says in the 7th chapter of the Gita, no? This divine energy, illusory energy, no, nonetheless divine, duratya, is difficult to cross, difficult to transcend. Krishna is saying difficult. What must be difficult for Krishna? I mean, he's beyond that. It's not that it's difficult for him, but he knows how difficult it's for us. I mean, he's seeing how we are trying and trying life after life without beginning. So it's difficult to transcend this maya, but he who has surrendered to me, he who has taken shelter in bhakti, very easily can transcend maya. So first two lines are showing like almost like an apocalyptic scenario. This maya shakti is almost impossible to transcend. And you are like, oh my God, no hope, I'm lost, what to do? I surrender, but not in the good sense, I give up. But then Krishna said, no, don't kill yourself. No. He who takes shelter in me, that thing which is the most difficult can that person can cross it relatively easily. Susukam kartumabhyam. So again, then after realizing, going back to the yogi realization, after realizing one's atomic self, the Atma, the yogi starts to meditate on the self as non-different from the indivisible, all-pervading Brahman, starts to engage in this process of internal, like, identification with that aspect. But again, during that that meditation and practice, he or she will invoke bhakti while keeping focus on the oneness of identity. So wanting that oneness experience, but knowing the necessity of bhakti. So due to the influence of devotion, will come this realization of oneness with Brahman, or what we call Brahman realization. Finally, this will manifest. But again, without the influence of bhakti, this won't take place. So, but again, I mentioned this point that the Goswamis over and over again emphasize. The yogi who attains that realization is not that they become Brahman in every single sense of the term, and they lose their individuality as Atma. They remain individuals, but fully identify with that Brahman experience. But retaining their individuality, although they are not aware of that. Like sometimes, example is deep sleep. Forgive. No? When you are in deep sleep means you are not even dreaming. Because in dreaming, you are aware, here I am, and the tiger is running after me. If you have a nightmare, or whatever. I'm meeting a devotee in Vrindavan, last night I had that experience. So I am there. I have a sense of I am. That's dream state. But deep sleep means no dreaming even. So you are not aware of you. But you are there. I mean, it's not that you were killed or stopped existing or something. But just there's non-awareness of you as an individual. And there's lots of peace in that. And that's why one awakens from that experience and say, oh, I rested so nicely. So that shows that you were there, actually. It's not that you stopped existing. Because if not, you wouldn't be saying, oh, such a nice resting I had. So you remain as an individual, but you experience this non-individuality, if you will, non-differentiation. And it was like, oh, such a relief of all these vrittis. Again, all these mind waves that sometimes when you are sleeping, oh my God, they really come to the surface. Many things from the subconscious and whatnot, as we say, they're from the shed. No? The shed of the subconscious, that you throw all that stuff that you don't want to deal directly. No, you're like, okay, what to do with this? Where should I put it? Put it in the shed. No problem. Open, okay. And you get even, you develop mechanism, whatever is not likable, shed, subconscious. At some point, as we say, the shed starts to have a life of its own. No? And you start to hear voices coming from the shed. I just see some hand coming. And maybe your child comes and says, Mom, please put this in the shed. I don't know if I would like to go there. I'm hearing some things there. No? But then we can open another shed. And we start to feel. And sometimes in dreams, all the things again. The shed opens and the dragon appears. So at one point you have to do something about it. So some ideas in connection to the dream and the deep sleep in connection to the peace of Brahman, being free from the shed, if you will. So again, it's difficult again to imagine the experience of Brahman in one sense because it's beyond imagination. But it's possible, and the point is that because Brahman is the, as we mentioned, the all-pervading aspect of God, undifferentiated aspect of divinity, the only way you can realize it is by a non-distinction form. I mean, you cannot realize the undifferentiated aspect of divinity in a personalized way with form and so on. That's not the non-differentiated aspect of divinity. If you go for Brahman, if you perceive yourself as distinct from Brahman, you cannot experience Brahman. You follow my point? Because Brahman is undifferentiated consciousness. He's all-pervading. You cannot have full realization of it if you retain the sense, I am an individual. You remain an individual, but you don't have that subjective experience. Hmm? Because if you have, you try to experience Brahman in that way, that contradicts the very nature of Brahman. If you say, Maharaj, I'm experiencing Brahma while being an individual and fully aware of my... That's not Brahma. Bhagavan cheated you and he's taking you to his side or something. That's Saguna Brahma. There is diversity there. Hmm? So again, in the experience of Brahman, there is no... if you start to analyze the experience of Brahman, technically speaking, there is no experience. Because there is no sense of individuality. So if there's no sense of individuality, who is experiencing what? Because there's nothing to experience and nobody to experience the experience. Do you follow my point? Mm-hmm. So in that sense, there is no. It's not that I'll go there and experience it. No. Mm-hmm. You cannot go be there with you. The sense of you has to disappear. And the sense of otherness. There's not two. No. There's just a sense of one. But there's no experience. Because for experience, you need someone experiencing and something being experienced. Or someone being experienced. So, that said, and with, of course, all respect, and that we accept that as a level of realization, we as bhaktas are not very much attracted to that direction. Because we would like to continue having experiences in the context of eternity, in the context of non-dualism, yeah. We are after absolute reality, non-dual consciousness, but again, we are after the form of the absolute which has a form, not a formless form, which affords us the opportunity for relationship and for loving interaction in the context of Lila, all of which is not happening in Nirguna Brahman because there's, again, nobody there in one sense. There's no sense of individuality. So here ends... Not the whole lecture, but Jiva Goswami's commentary. Do we have some few minutes? I would like to finish very briefly with three more commentaries, but they're just short lines, I promise, believe me. No. To begin with, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he basically makes a mention here, says, though only pure Prem Bhakti gives directly realization of the sweet form of Krishna, through Gyan mixed with Bhakti, one can attain realization of impersonal Brahman, which is basically what we have been saying. No? By Gyan mixed with Bhakti, you can realize Brahman in an impersonal feature. But by Prem Bhakti, not just by following the four regs and chanting 16 rounds, as we were speaking today, it's not just like I do copy-paste of some formula and externally keep that without internally doing the homework. No, by pure Prem Bhakti, Prem Bhakti is already pure, but just in case, pure Prem Bhakti, you will have direct realization of the sweet form of Krishna. Hmm? Then Srinivasa Suri, another commentator of the Bhagavatam, we will see two more commentaries which are more devotional. As we say, the Sanskrit lends itself to layers of interpretation. So till now, the main focus was Brahman, but they will interpret some words as to Parabrahman, the absolute supreme Bhagavan Sri Krishna. So Srinivasa Suri says in verse 2, Brahma said, these four verses back, I, though Brahma, am unable to fathom the glory of this body of yours. This means, Srinivasa Suri says, he could not understand Krishna's glory because his mind and senses were clouded, vimohan. Now, Brahma is saying, nevertheless, your glory can be directly experienced by those whose senses are pure and who are intent on seeing your divine body. So he interprets the same idea in connection to Brahman and direction to Krishna. How? By one's transcendental experience. So, your glory, your form, sweet personal form of Sri Krishna can be experienced. Your divine body can be seen. Premanjita Charita Bhakti Vilochanena. By he or she whose eyes are anointed with the salve of love. That will give a particular experience. Bhakti Pareshanu Bhavu Viraktir, says Krishna in the Bhagavatam. When you engage in bhakti, another like byproducts, kamas, concomitant effects. Now you increase your devotion because you are practicing bhakti for the sake of bhakti, but paresha anubhava, paresha anubhava, you have realization of paresha, of the Supreme Being. Ambirakti, you experience detachment from other things because you are experiencing so much taste and attachment that naturally other things start to not be so attractive. And finally, to conclude, Srinath Chakrabarti, another devotional interpretation, very briefly, he's saying, bhakti originates only by the kata of your qualities, and by such bhakti, you are easily attained. Bhakti is not inherent. Originates, comes from bhakti. Nevertheless, can the glory of your qualities be described? No. That is what Brahma says here. So again, according to him and many others, at the end of the day, what Brahma is trying to mention is, even Brahman is one aspect of your qualities, and I cannot fully even describe that. What to speak of all the other qualities, what you speak of your form that I'm seeing now, I'm overwhelmed. No, Brahma is still Vimohan, as we mentioned, but in an upgraded way. No? So in the next verse that we will be seeing Wednesday, we have one more lecture, surprise, it came just out today, so Bhakti Rasa will give the details, and for those connected, next Wednesday, basically, same time, we will see next verse, which will be verse 7, and which will conclude like one section of the prayers, which revolve around certain topics. Then from verse 8, in another direction, the prayers will continue. So hopefully you can come, so we close this section altogether. So in this connection that Brahma is saying here, your qualities, the glory of your qualities cannot be described, not even one of those qualities. In the next verse, Brahma will basically continue exhibiting his upgraded Vimohan, if you will. He maximized bewilderment. No, because before he was bewildered by thinking Krishna is an imposter, and then like what's going on? All the cubs and boys remain here, but they are in the cave, and then forms of Narayan coming from them, and then all those forms disappear, and Krishna just with a morsel of food, like looking for the calves and boys, forehead spinning, and then Brahma puts the foreheads on the ground, starts to pray to Krishna, and by that sincere praying, new realizations come into his heart about who Krishna is, the nature of his form, and so on. So new level of bewilderment is coming now to Brahma, no? Like, wow, what's this? No. Chamatkar means like astonishment. No. So in each one of these verses, there will be this escalating of transcendental bewilderment. So in the next verse that will conclude this first section of prayers, Brahma will express this. Now, how impossible it's to fathom the endless qualities of Sri Hari. So stay in tune, and hopefully see you in a few days. So we are almost done here, unless you have some question or something you may like to add or share in connection to today's topic.
I do have a question, Maharaj.
Yes.
So I was reading in the Adi Leela today, and I've never really read through all of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. I've only gleaned from what everybody else has read and shared. So the part I understand is that the Leelas keep going, right? And you were talking earlier about how, he just comes and he's there, and it's not always, like, he's in other places also. It all kind of goes together. So the part that I ended in this morning was when Krishna says, okay, I need to understand, and he, boom, here he is, right, as Lord Chaitanya. So my question is then, does that rasa with the maidens just kind of just keep going, and they think he's there, but he's really kind of like there and not there.
I don't understand which are the two parallel.
Like in Vrindavan.
Vrindavan and Gaur Lila?
Right. So like,
what happens to Krishna and the gopis in Vrindavan when Krishna comes here and advents as Lord Chaitanya?
Yeah. I understand it keeps going. But
mm-hmm.
Our story doesn't keep going that direction. Our Leela, right? We catch this glimpse here and not the rest of this. If that's too loaded, we can do that another day.
Yeah, we explained something of that when we gave the series on Brahma Gita, the song of the bumblebee, that was last year. Mm-hmm. And I spoken with Krishna, left Vrindavan and returned to Vrindavan, and the Prakat Leela and the Aprakat Leela, and how actually, for example, Krishna is executing his Leela on earth, let's say. Let's travel 5,000 years back in time. We are here, Krishna executing his Leela here.
Right.
But it doesn't mean that he's not in Golok Vrindavan. I'm sorry if I'm doing like that. I don't want like to point to a geographical location. But we hear these terms, like Prakat, Aprakat, the Leela on earth and the unmanifest Leela. And Krishna remains there. It's not that you go to Golok Vrindavan and it's a sign saying, gone to earth, right. see you soon or something.
Right.
No? Because also we hear that whenever one Leela of Krishna on earth closes, it starts somewhere else on another planet earth in another universe. like Gunraj will say, it's always 12 p.m. somewhere on planet earth. No? Not always in the same place, but somewhere is always that time. So somewhere in some planet earth, in some universe, Krishna is performing his Leela. So my point is don't try to think too much. But there's always Krishna Leela being performed on earth at every moment. So I'm saying this in the sense that Krishna won't say, I've gone to earth returning after closing the Leela, because the Leela is always continuing somewhere else. So that means what? That Golok Vrindavan is empty forever? No. So Krishna is always in Golok Vrindavan. That means that then he's coming to earth is empty forever? No. He's always coming to... So already there you have two simultaneous realities, and whenever you attain that level, if you will, you will be participating in both. And on top of that, you have Gaur Leela, which also has its corresponding expression on Earth, and it's always going on in some planet Earth, and it's always going on in Nitya Navadu, Golok Navadu. So if you want, in that sense, you can speak in... But at the present moment, we have enough to deal with the one, no? With this one. So as long as we do our homework with this one sense of identity and mind properly, gradually, we will be able to accommodate 2, 3, 4. So I will put it till there. No? But everything will be fine, no problem. Everything will be harmonized. Yeah. Okay. So it's more than 1.5 hours, so I think we can finish here and continue next Wednesday. Thank you so much for coming. Srila Gurudev ki jai, Sriman Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Sankirtan ki jai, Sri Sri Gauradha Madhav ki jai, Grantara Srimad Bhagavatam ki jai, Sri Brahma Stuti ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Premanand Hari.